political leader, or even a Supreme Court judge back then. But as time went by, I settled into a routine. Even as a cocky litigator, Julian used to tell me that complacency kills. The more I thought about it, the more I realized that I had lost my hunger. This wasn't a hunger for a bigger house or a faster car. This was a far deeper hunger. Hunger for living with more meaning, with more festivity, and more satisfaction. I started to daydream while Julian continued to talk. Oblivious to what he was now saying, I saw myself first as a 50-year-old and then as a 60-year-old man. Would I be stuck in the same job with the same people, facing the same struggles at that point of my life? I dreaded that. I had always wanted to contribute to the world in some way, and I sure wasn't doing it now. I think it was at that moment, with Julian sitting next to me on my living room floor on that sticky July night, that I changed. The Japanese call it Satori, meaning instant awakening, and that's exactly what it was. I resolved to fulfill my dreams and make my life far more than it had ever been. That was my first taste of real freedom, the freedom that comes when you decide once and for all to take charge of your life and all its constituent elements. "I will give you a formula for developing willpower," said Julian, who had no idea of the inner transformation I had just experienced. "Wisdom without proper tools for its application is no wisdom at all." He continued, "Every day, while you are walking to work, I would like you to repeat a few simple words." "Is this one of those mantras you told me about earlier?" I asked. "Yes, it is. It is one that has been in existence for over 5,000 years, although only the small band of Sivanan monks have known about it. Yogi Raman told me that by its repetition, I would develop self-control and an indomitable will within a short period of time. Remember, words are great influences. Words are the verbal embodiment of power. By filling your mind with words of hope, you become hopeful. By filling your mind with words of kindness, you become kind. By filling your mind with thoughts of courage, you become courageous." "Words have power," Julian observed. "Okay, I'm all ears." "This is the mantra I suggest you repeat at least 30 times a day. I am more than I appear to be. All the world's strength and power rests inside me. It will manifest profound changes in your life. For even quicker results, blend this mantra with the practice of creative envisioning I spoke of earlier. For example, go to a quiet place. Sit with your eyes closed. Do not let your mind wander. Keep your body still, as the surest sign of a weak mind is a body that cannot rest. Now repeat the mantra aloud, over and over again. While you do so, see yourself as a disciplined, firm person, fully in control of your mind, your body, and your spirit. Picture yourself acting as Gandhi or Mother Teresa might act in a challenging situation. Startling results will surely come your way," he promised. "That's it?" I asked, astonished by the apparent simplicity of this formula. "I can tap the full reserves of my willpower through this simple exercise?" "This technique has been taught by the spiritual teachers of the East for centuries. It is still around today for one reason, because it works. As always, judge by results. If you are interested, there are a couple of other exercises I can offer you to liberate the strength of your will and cultivate inner discipline. But let me warn you that they might seem strange at first." "Hey, Julian, I'm absolutely fascinated by what I've been hearing. You're on a roll, so don't stop now." "Okay. The first thing is to start doing the things you don't like doing. For you, it might be as simple as making your bed in the morning, or walking rather than driving to work. By getting into the habit of exercising your will, you will cease to be a slave to your weaker impulses." "Use it or lose it?" "Exactly. To build willpower and inner strength, you must first use it. The more you exert and nurture the embryo of self-discipline, the more quickly it will mature and give you the results you desire. The second exercise is a favorite of Yogi Raman's. He used to go an entire day without speaking, except in response to a direct question. Kind of like a vow of silence. Actually, that's exactly what it was, John. The Tibetan monks who popularized this practice believed that to hold one's tongue for an extended period of time would have the effect of enhancing one's discipline. But how? Basically, by keeping silent for a day, you are conditioning your will to do as you command it to do. Each time the urge to speak arises, you actively curb this impulse and remain quiet. You see, your will does not have a mind of its own. It waits for you to give it instructions that will spur it into action. The more control you exert over it, the more powerful it will become. The problem is that most people don't use their willpower. Why is that? I asked. Probably because most people believe they don't have any. They blame everyone and everything except themselves for this apparent weakness. Those who have a vicious temper will tell you, I can't help it. My father was the same way. Those who worry too much will tell you, it's not my fault. My job is too stressful. Those who sleep too much will say, what can I do? My body needs 10 hours of sleep a night. Such people lack the self-responsibility that comes through knowing the extraordinary potential that lies deep within every one of us, waiting to be inspired into action. When you come to know the timeless laws of nature, those that govern the operation of this universe and all that lives within it, you will also know that it is your birthright to be all that you can be. You have the power to be more than your environment. Similarly, you have the capacity to be more than a prisoner of your past. To do this, you must become the master of your will. Sounds heavy. Really, it's a very practical concept. Imagine what you could do if you doubled or tripled the amount of willpower that you currently have. You could get into that exercise regimen you have dreamed of starting. You could be far more efficient with your time. You could erase the worry habit once and for all. Or you could be the ideal husband. Using your will allows you to rekindle the drive and energy for living that you seem to be saying you've lost. It is a very important area to focus on. So the bottom line is to start using my willpower on a regular basis. Yes. Decide to do the things you know you should be doing, rather than walking the path of least resistance. Start to fight the gravitational force of your bad habits and weaker impulses, just as a rocket rises above the force of gravity to enter the realm of the heavens. Push yourself. Just watch what will happen in a matter of weeks. And the mantra will help? Yes. Repeating the mantra I gave you, along with the daily practice of seeing yourself as you hope to be, will give you an enormous amount of support as you create the disciplined, principled life that will connect you to your dreams. And you need not change your world in a day. Start off small. The 1,000-mile journey begins by taking that first step. We grow great by degrees. Even training yourself to get up an hour earlier and sticking to this wonderful habit will boost your self-confidence, inspiring you to reach higher heights. I don't see the connection, I admitted. Small victories lead to large victories. You must build on the small to achieve the great. By following through on a resolution as simple as getting up earlier every day, you will feel the pleasure and gratification that achievement brings. You have set a goal and you have realized it. This feels good. The trick is to keep setting the mark higher and raising your standards continuously. This will then release that magical quality of momentum that will motivate you to keep exploring your infinite potential. Do you like to ski? Julian questioned abruptly. I love skiing, I replied. Jenny and I take the kids up to the mountains whenever we can, which isn't very often, much to her dismay. Okay. Just think of what it's like when you push off from the top of the ski hill. At first you start off slowly, but within a minute you are flying down the hill like there's no tomorrow, right? Just call me Ninja Skier. I love the rush of speed. What gets you going so fast? My aerodynamically contoured physique, I quipped. Nice try, Julian laughed. Momentum is the answer I'm looking for. Momentum is also the secret ingredient to building self-discipline. Like I said, you start off small, whether that means getting up a little earlier, starting to walk around the block every night, or even just training yourself to turn off the television when you know you have had enough. These small victories create the momentum that excites you to take larger steps along the path to your highest self. Soon you are doing things that you never knew you were capable of doing, with a vigor and energy that you never thought you had. It's a delightful process, John. It really is. And the pink wire cable in Yogi Raman's magical fable will always remind you of the power of your will. Just as Julian finished revealing his thoughts on the subject of discipline, I noticed the first rays of the sun peeking into the living room, pushing away the darkness like a child pushes away an unwanted bed cover. This will be a great day, I thought. The first day of the rest of my life. Chapter 10. Action Summary. Julian's Wisdom in a Nutshell. The Symbol. The Pink Wire Cable. The Virtue. Life with Discipline. The Wisdom. Discipline is built by consistently performing small acts of courage. The more you nurture the embryo of self-discipline, the more it will mature. Willpower is the essential virtue of a fully actualized life. The techniques. Mantras. Creative envisioning. The vow of silence. Quotable quote. Wage war against the weaker thoughts that have crept into the palace of your mind. They will see that they are unwanted and leave like unwelcome visitors. The monk who sold his Ferrari. Chapter 11. Your Most Precious Commodity. Well-arranged time is the surest mark of a well-arranged mind. Sir Isaac Pitman. You know what's funny about life? Julian asked me. Tell me. By the time most people figure out what they really want and how to go about attaining it, it's usually too late. That saying, if youth only knew, if age only could, is so true. Is that what the stopwatch in Yogi Raman's fable is all about? Yes. The naked 9-foot-tall, 900-pound sumo wrestler with the pink wire cable covering his private parts slips on a shiny gold stopwatch that someone has left in the beautiful garden, Julian reminded me. How could I forget? I replied, breaking into a grin. By now, I had realized that Yogi Raman's mystical fable was nothing more than a series of memory pegs designed to teach Julian the elements of his ancient philosophy for enlightened living, while at the same time helping him remember it. I shared my discovery with him. Ah, the sixth sense of a litigator. You are quite right. My wise teacher's methods appeared odd at first, and I struggled to understand the significance of his tale, just as you wondered what I was speaking of when I first shared it with you. But I must tell you, John, all seven elements of the story, from the garden and the naked sumo wrestler to the yellow roses and the path of diamonds, which I am soon getting to, serve as powerful reminders of the wisdom I learned in Savannah. The garden keeps me focused on inspiring thoughts. The lighthouse reminds me that the purpose of life is a life of purpose. The sumo wrestler keeps me centered on continuous self-discovery, while the pink wire cable links me to the wonders of willpower. A day doesn't pass without me thinking about the fable and considering the principles Yogi Raman taught me. And exactly what does the shiny gold stopwatch represent? It is a symbol of our most important commodity, time. What about positive thinking and goal-getting and self-mastery? They all mean nothing without time. About 6 months after I made the delightful forest retreat in Savannah my temporary home, one of the sages came to my hut of roses while I was studying. Her name was Devaya. She was a stunningly beautiful woman with jet-black hair that fell just below her waist, and in a very gentle and sweet voice, she informed me that she was the youngest of all the sages living in that secret mountain abode. She also said that she had come to me on the instructions of Yogi Raman, who had told her that I was the best student he had ever had. "Maybe it is all the pain you suffered in your former life that has allowed you to embrace our wisdom with such an open heart," she stated. "As the youngest of our community, I have been asked to bring you a gift. It is from all of us, and we offer it as a token of our respect for you, one who has traveled so far to learn our ways. At no point have you judged us or ridiculed our traditions. So, though you have now decided to leave us within a few weeks, we consider you one of our own. No outsider has ever received what I am about to give you." "What was the gift?" I asked impatiently. Devaya pulled out an object from her homespun cotton bag and handed it to me. Wrapped in a fragrant cover of some type of paper was something I never thought I'd see there in a million years. It was a miniature hourglass that had been made from blown glass and a small piece of sandalwood. Seeing my expression, Devaya quickly told me that each of the sages had received one of these instruments as children. "Though we have no possessions and live pure, simple lives, we respect time and note its passing. These little hourglasses serve as daily reminders of our mortality and the importance of living full, productive days while advancing our purposes." "These monks up in the highest reaches of the Himalayan mountains kept time?" "Each and every one of them understood the importance of time. They each had developed what I call a time consciousness. You see, I learned that time slips through our hands like grains of sand, never to return. Those who use time wisely from an early age are rewarded with rich, productive, and satisfying lives. Those who have never been exposed to the principle that time mastery is life mastery will never realize their enormous human potential. Time is the great leveler. Whether we are privileged or disadvantaged, whether we live in Texas or Tokyo, we have all been allotted days with only 24 hours. What separates those who build exceptional lives from the also-rans is the way they use this time. I once heard my father say that it was the busiest people who have time to spare. What do you make of that?"
"I agree.
Busy, productive people are highly efficient with their time. They must be in order to survive. Being an excellent time manager doesn't mean that you must become a workaholic. On the contrary, time mastery allows you more time to do the things you love to do, the things that are truly meaningful to you. Time mastery leads to life mastery. Guard time well. Remember, it's a non-renewable resource." "Let me give you an example," Julian offered. "Let's say it's Monday morning, and your schedule is overflowing with appointments, meetings, and court appearances. Rather than getting up at your usual 6:30 a.m., gulping down a cup of Java, speeding off to work, and then spending a stressful day of catch-up, let's say you took 15 minutes the night before to plan your day. Or to be even more effective, let's say you took 1 hour on your quiet Sunday morning to organize your entire week. In your daily planner, you wrote out when you would meet with your clients, when you would do legal research, and when you would return phone calls. Most importantly, your personal, social, and spiritual development goals for the week also went into your agenda book. This simple act is the secret to a life of balance. By anchoring all the most vital aspects of your life into your daily schedule, you ensure that your week and your life retain a sense of meaning and peace."
Surely you're not suggesting that I take a break in the middle of my busy workday to walk in the park or meditate. I sure am. Why are you so rigidly bound to convention? Why do you feel that you have to do things the same way as everyone else? Run your own race. Why not start working an hour earlier so that you will have the luxury of taking a serene mid-morning walk in that beautiful park across from your office? Or why not put in a few extra hours at the beginning of your week so that you can cut out early on Friday to take your kids to the zoo? Or why not start working at home 2 days a week so that you can see more of your family? All I'm saying is plan your week and manage your time creatively. Have the discipline to focus your time around your priorities. The most meaningful things in your life should never be sacrificed to those that are the least meaningful. And remember, failing to plan is planning to fail. By writing down not only your appointments with others, but also those all-important appointments with yourself to read, relax, or write a love letter to your wife, you will be far more productive with your time. Never forget that time spent enriching your non-work hours is never a waste. It makes you tremendously efficient during your working hours. Stop living your life in compartments and understand once and for all that all you do forms one indivisible whole. The way you act at home affects the way you act at work. The way you treat people at the office affects the way you will treat your family and friends. I agree, Julian, but I really don't have the time to take breaks in the middle of my day. As it is, I work most evenings. My schedule is really crushing these days. As I said this, I felt my stomach tingling at the mere thought of the mountain of work I was facing. Being busy is no excuse. The real question is, what are you so busy about? One of the great rules I learned from that wise old sage is that 80% of the results you achieve in your life come from only 20% of the activities that occupy your time. Yogi Raman called it the ancient rule of 20. I'm not sure I follow you. Okay, let's go back to your busy Monday. From morning until night, you might spend your time doing everything from chatting on the phone with clients and drafting legal pleadings to reading your youngest child a bedtime story or playing chess with your wife. Agreed? Agreed. But out of all of the hundreds of activities you give your time to, only 20% of those will yield real, lasting results. Only 20% of what you do will have an influence on the quality of your life. These are your high-impact activities. For example, 10 years from now, do you really think all the time you spent gossiping at the water cooler, or sitting in some smoke-filled lunchroom, or watching television will count for anything? No, not really. Right. So I'm sure you will also agree that there are a number of activities that will count for everything. You mean like time spent improving my legal knowledge, time spent enriching my relationships with my clients, and time invested in becoming a more efficient lawyer? Yes. And time spent nourishing your relationship with Jenny and the kids. Time spent connecting with nature and showing gratitude for all that you are so fortunate to have. Time spent renewing your mind, your body, and your spirit. These are just a few of the high-impact activities that will allow you to design the life you deserve. Direct all of your time to those activities that count. Enlightened people are priority-driven. This is the secret of time mastery. Wow, Yogi Raman taught you all that? I have become a student of life, John. Yogi Raman certainly was a wonderful and inspiring teacher, and I will never forget him for that. But all of the lessons I have learned from my varied experiences have now come together like pieces of a big jigsaw puzzle to show me the way to a better life. Julian added, I hope you will learn from my earlier mistakes. Some people learn from the errors others have made. They are the wise. Others feel that true learning comes only from personal experience. Such people endure needless pain and distress over the course of their lives. I had been to many seminars on time management as a lawyer. Yet I had never heard the philosophy of time mastery that Julian was now sharing with me. Time management was not just something to focus on at the office and discard at closing time. It was a holistic system that could make all areas of my life more balanced and fulfilling, if I applied it correctly. I learned that by planning my days and taking the time to ensure that I was balanced in the use of my time, I would not only be far more productive, I would be far happier. "So life is like a fat strip of bacon," I chimed in. "You have to separate the meat from the fat in order to be the master of your time." "Very good. You're onto it now. And though my vegetarian side tells me to do otherwise, I love the analogy because it hits the nail right on the head. When you spend your time and precious mental energy focusing on the meat, you have no time to waste on the fat. This is the point at which your life moves from the realm of the ordinary into the exquisiteness of the extraordinary. This is when you really start to make things happen, and the doors to the temple of enlightenment suddenly swing open," Julian observed. "That brings me to another point. Don't let others steal your time. Be wary of time thieves. These are the people who always call on the telephone, just as you have put the kids to sleep and have settled into your favorite chair to read that thrilling novel you have heard so much about. These are the people who have a knack of dropping by your office, just as you have found a few minutes in the midst of a hectic day to catch your breath and collect your thoughts. Does this sound familiar?" "As usual, Julian, you're right on the money. I guess I have always been too polite to ask them to leave or to keep my door shut," I confided. "You must be ruthless with your time. Learn to say no. Having the courage to say no to the little things in life will give you the power to say yes to the big things. Shut the door to your office when you need a few hours to work on that big case. Remember what I told you. Don't pick up the phone every time it rings. It is there for your convenience, not the convenience of others. Ironically, people will respect you more when they see that you are a person who values his time. They will realize that your time is precious, and they will value it." "What about procrastination? All too often I keep putting off the things that I don't like doing, and instead find myself sifting through junk mail or flipping through legal magazines. Maybe I'm just killing time?" "Killing time is an apt metaphor. True, it is human nature to do things that feel good and avoid the things that feel bad. But as I said earlier, the most productive people in this world have cultivated the habit of doing the things that less productive people don't like doing, even though they too might not like doing them."
I stopped and thought deeply about the principle I had just heard. Perhaps procrastination was not my problem. Maybe my life had simply become too complex. Julian sensed my concern. "Yogi Raman told me that those who are masters of their time live simple lives. A hurried, frenzied pace is not what nature intended. While he firmly believed that lasting happiness could be reached only by those who were effective and set definite aims for themselves, living a life rich with accomplishment and contribution did not have to come through the sacrifice of peace of mind. This is what I found so fascinating about the wisdom I was hearing. It allowed me to be productive and yet fulfill my spiritual longings." I started to open myself even more to Julian. "You have always been honest and forthright with me, so I will be the same with you. I don't want to give up my practice and my house and my car to be happier and more satisfied. I like my toys and the material things I have earned. They are my rewards for all the hours I have worked over the years since we first met. But I feel empty, I really do. I told you about my dreams when I was in law school. There is so much more I could do with my life. You know, I'm almost 40, and I have never been to the Grand Canyon or the Eiffel Tower. I've never walked in a desert or canoed across a still lake on a gorgeous summer's day. I have never once taken off my socks and shoes and walked barefoot through a park, listened to the kids laugh and the dogs bark. I can't even remember the last time I took a long, quiet walk by myself after a snowfall, just to hear the sounds and to enjoy the sensations. Then simplify your life, Julian suggested sympathetically. Apply the ancient ritual of simplicity to every aspect of your world. By doing so, you are bound to have more time to savor these glorious wonders. One of the most tragic things that any one of us can do is to put off living. Too many people are dreaming of some magical rose garden on the horizon, rather than enjoying the one growing in our backyards.
What a tragedy. Oh, that reminds me of another thing that I do to make sure my life stays calm and simple. What's that? I love to have a quick nap in the afternoon. I find it keeps me energetic, refreshed, and youthful. I guess you could say that I need my beauty sleep. Julian laughed. Beauty has never been one of your strong points. A sense of humor has always been one of yours, and for this I commend you. Always remember the power of laughter. Like music, it is a wonderful tonic for life's stresses and strains. I think Yogi Raman said it best when he said, "Laughter opens your heart and soothes your soul." No one should ever take life so seriously that they forget to laugh at themselves. Julian had one final thought to share on the subject of time. Perhaps most importantly, John, stop acting like you have 500 years to live. When Devea brought that little hourglass to me, she offered some advice that I will never forget. What did she say? She told me that the best time to plant a tree was 40 years ago. The second best time is today. Don't waste even 1 minute of your day. Develop a deathbed mentality. I beg your pardon, I asked, struck by the graphic term Julian had employed. What's a deathbed mentality? It is a new way of looking at your life, a more empowering paradigm, if you will. One that reminds you that today could be your last, so savor it to the fullest. Sounds kind of morbid, if you ask me. It makes me think about death. Actually, it's a philosophy about life. When you adopt a deathbed mentality, you live every day as if it was your last. Imagine waking up every day and asking yourself the simple question, what would I do today if it was my last? Then think about how you would treat your family, your colleagues, and even those who you don't know. Think about how productive and excited you would be to live every moment to the maximum. The deathbed question alone has the power to change your life. It will energize your days and bring a rush of zest and spirit to all that you do. You will start focusing on all the meaningful things that you have been putting off, and stop squandering time on all those petty things that have dragged you down into the quagmire of crisis and chaos. Julian continued, push yourself to do more and to experience more. Harness your energy to start expanding your dreams. Yes, expand your dreams. Don't accept a life of mediocrity when you hold such infinite potential within the fortress of your mind. Dare to tap into your greatness. This is your birthright. Powerful stuff. Here's more. There is a simple remedy to break the spell of frustration that plagues so many people. My cup is still empty, I said softly. Act as if failure is impossible, and your success will be assured. Wipe out every thought of not achieving your objectives, whether they are material or spiritual. Be brave, and set no limits on the workings of your imagination. Never be a prisoner of your past. Become the architect of your future. You will never be the same. As the city started to awaken, and the morning grew into full bloom, my ageless friend started to show the first signs of weariness after a night spent sharing his knowledge with an eager student. I had been astonished by Julian's stamina, his boundless energy, and his endless enthusiasm. He not only talked his talk, he walked his walk. We are moving to the end of Yogi Raman's magical fable, and approaching the time when I must leave you, he said gently. I have much to do, and many more people to meet. Are you going to tell your partners that you have returned home? I asked, my curiosity getting the better of me. Probably not, Julian replied. I am so different from the Julian Mantle they knew. I don't think the same thoughts. I don't wear the same clothes. I don't do the same things. I am a fundamentally changed person. They wouldn't recognize me. You really are a new man, I agreed, chuckling inwardly as I pictured this mystical monk adorned in the traditional robes of Sivana, stepping into the striking red Ferrari of his former life. A new being is probably even more accurate. I don't see the distinction, I confessed. There is an ancient saying in India. We are not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. I now understand my role in the universe. I see what I am. I'm no longer in the world. The world is in me. I'm going to have to chew on that one for a while, I said, in total honesty, not quite comprehending what Julian was talking about. Sure, I understand, my friend. A time will come when you are clear on what I am saying. If you follow the principles I have revealed to you and apply the techniques I have offered, you will surely advance along the path of enlightenment. You will come to master the art of personal government. You will see your life for what it really is, a small blip on the canvas of eternity. And you will come to see clearly who you are and the ultimate purpose of your life. Which is? To serve, of course. No matter how big a house you have or how slick a car you drive, the only thing you can take with you at the end of your life is your conscience. Listen to your conscience. Let it guide you. It knows what is right. It will tell you that your calling in life is ultimately selfless service to others in some form or another. This is what my personal odyssey has taught me. Now, I have so many others to see, serve, and heal. My mission is to spread the ancient wisdom of the sages of Sivana to all those who need to hear it. This is my purpose. The fire of knowledge had kindled Julian's spirit. This was obvious, even to an unenlightened soul such as myself. He was so passionate, so committed, and so fervent about what he was saying, that it was reflected even in his physical dimension. His transformation from a frail old litigator to a vital young Adonis was not brought about by a simple change in his diet and a daily dose of some quick-fix exercise plan. No, it was a far deeper panacea that Julian had stumbled upon high in those majestic mountains. He had found the secret that people through the ages have been searching for. It was more than the secret of youth, fulfillment, or even happiness. Julian had discovered the secret of the self. Chapter 11. Action Summary. Julian's Wisdom in a Nutshell. The Symbol. The Gold Stopwatch. The Virtue. Respect your time. The Wisdom. Time is your most precious commodity, and it is non-renewable. Focus on your priorities and maintain balance. Simplify your life. The techniques. The ancient rule of 20. Have the courage to say no. The deathbed mentality. Quotable quote. Time slips through our hands like grains of sand, never to return again. Those who use time wisely from an early age are rewarded with rich, productive, and satisfying lives. The monk who sold his Ferrari. Chapter 12. The Ultimate Purpose of Life. Everything that lives, lives not alone, not for itself. William Blake. The sages of Sivana were not only the most youthful people I have ever met, observed Julian. They were also, without a doubt, the kindest. Yogi Rahman told me that when he was a child, as he waited for sleep, his father would step softly into his rose-covered hut and ask him what good deeds he had performed through the course of that day. Believe it or not, if he said that he hadn't done any, his father would request that he get up and perform some act of kindness and selfless service before he was permitted to go to sleep. Julian went on. One of the most essential of all of the virtues for enlightened living that I can share with you, John, is this one. When all is said and done, no matter what you have achieved, no matter how many summer homes you own, no matter how many cars sit in your driveway, the quality of your life will come down to the quality of your contribution. Does this have something to do with the fresh yellow roses in Yogi Rahman's fable? Of course it does. The flowers will remind you of the ancient Chinese proverb. A little bit of fragrance always clings to the hand that gives you roses. The meaning is clear. When you work to improve the lives of others, you indirectly elevate your own life in the process. When you take care to practice random acts of kindness daily, your own life becomes far richer and more meaningful. To cultivate the sacredness and sanctity of each day, serve others in some way. Are you suggesting that I get involved in some volunteer work? That's an excellent starting point. But what I'm speaking of is much more philosophical than that. I'm suggesting that you adopt a new paradigm of your role on this planet. You're losing me again. Shed some light on the term paradigm. I'm not really familiar with it. A paradigm is simply a way of looking at a circumstance, or at life in general. Some people see the glass of life as half empty. The optimists see it as half full. They interpret the same circumstance differently because they have adopted a different paradigm. A paradigm is basically the lens through which you see the events of your life, both external and internal. So when you suggest that I adopt a new paradigm of my purpose, are you saying that I should change my outlook? Sort of. To dramatically improve the quality of your life, you must cultivate a new perspective of why you are here on Earth. You must realize that just as you entered the world with nothing, you are destined to leave with nothing. This being the case, there can be only one real reason for your being here. And that would be to give yourself to others and to contribute in a meaningful way, Julian replied. I'm not saying that you can't have your toys, or that you must give up your law practice and devote your life to the disadvantaged, although I have recently met people who have taken this course of action with great satisfaction. Our world is in the midst of great change. People are trading in money for meaning. Lawyers who used to judge people by the size of their pocketbooks are now judging people by the size of their commitments to others, by the size of their hearts. Teachers are leaving the wombs of their secure jobs to nurture the intellectual growth of needy kids living in the combat zones we call inner cities. People have heard the clear call for change. People are realizing that they are here for a purpose and that they have been given special gifts that will aid them to realize it. What kind of special gifts? Exactly the ones I have been telling you about all evening. An abundance of mental ability, boundless energy, unlimited creativity, a storehouse of discipline, and a wellspring of peacefulness. It is simply a matter of unlocking these treasures and applying them for some common good, noted Julian. I'm still with you. So how can one go about doing good? I'm simply saying that you should make it a priority to change your worldview so that you stop seeing yourself purely as an individual and start seeing yourself as part of the collective. So I should become kinder and gentler. Realize that the most noble thing you can do is to give to others. The sages of the East call it the process of shedding the shackles of self. It is all about losing your self-consciousness and starting to focus on a higher purpose. This might be in the form of giving more to those around you, whether this means your time or your energy. These truly are your two most valuable resources. It could be something as major as taking a one-year sabbatical to work with the poor, or something as minor as letting a few cars pass in front of you in the middle of a crushing traffic jam. It might sound corny, but if there is one thing that I have learned, it is that your life moves to a more magical dimension when you start striving to make the world a better place. Yogi Raman said that when we are born, we are crying while the world rejoices. He suggested that we should live our lives in such a way that when we die, the world cries while we are rejoicing. I knew Julian had a point. One of the things that was starting to bother me about practicing law was that I didn't really feel I was making the sort of contribution I knew I was capable of making. Sure, I had the privilege of litigating a number of precedent-setting cases that had advanced a number of good causes. But law had become a business for me, rather than a labor of love. I was an idealist in law school, like so many of my contemporaries. Over cold coffee and stale pizza in our dorm rooms, we had planned to change the world. Almost 20 years have passed since then, and my burning desire to advocate change has given way to my burning desire to pay off my mortgage and build up my retirement fund. I realized, for the first time in a long while, that I had ensconced myself in a middle-class cocoon, one that sheltered me from society at large, and one I had grown accustomed to. "Let me share an old story with you that might really hit home," Julian continued. "There was once a feeble old woman whose loving husband died. So she went to live with her son and his wife and daughter. Every day the woman's sight grew worse, and her hearing grew worse. Some days her hands trembled so badly, the peas on her plate rolled onto the floor, and the soup ran from her cup. Her son and his wife couldn't help but be annoyed at the mess she made, and one day they said enough was enough. So they set up a little table for the old woman, in a corner next to the broom closet, and made her eat all of her meals there, alone. She would look at them at mealtimes, with tear-filled eyes from across the room, but they hardly talked to her while they ate, except to scold her for dropping a spoon or a fork. One evening, just before dinner, the little girl was sitting on the floor playing with her building blocks. 'What are you making?' her father asked earnestly. 'I'm building a little table for you and mother,' she said, 'so that you can eat by yourselves in the corner some day when I get big.' The father and mother were moved to silence for what seemed like an eternity. Then they started to weep. In that instant, they became aware of the nature of their actions and the sadness they had caused. That night, they led the old woman back to her rightful place at their big dinner table, and from that day on, she ate all her meals with them. And when a little morsel of food fell off the table, or a fork strayed onto the floor, nobody seemed to mind anymore." In this story, the parents were not bad people, Julian said. They simply needed the spark of awareness to light their candle of compassion. Compassion and daily acts of kindness make life far richer. Take the time to meditate every morning on the good you will do for others during your day. The sincere words of praise to those who least expect it. The gestures of warmth offered to friends in need. The small tokens of affection to members of your family for no reason at all. All add up to a much more wonderful way to live. And speaking of friendships, make sure you keep them in constant repair. A person with 3 solid friends is very wealthy indeed." I nodded. "Friends add humor, fascination, and beauty to life. There are few things more rejuvenating than sharing a belly-bursting laugh with an old friend. Friends keep you humble when you get too self-righteous. Friends make you smile when you are taking yourself too seriously. Good friends are there to help you when life throws one of its little curves at you and things look worse than they seem. When I was a busy litigator, I had no time for friends. Now I am alone, except for you, John. I have no one to take long walks in the woods with when everyone else is nestled into the cocoon of a soft, hazy slumber. When I have just put down a wonderful book that has moved me deeply, I have no one to share my thoughts with. And I have no one to open my soul to when the sunshine of a glorious autumn day warms my heart and fills me with joy. Julian quickly caught himself. However, regret is not an activity for which I have any time. I have learned from my teachers in Savannah that every dawn is a new day to the one who is enlightened. I had always viewed Julian as a sort of superhuman legal gladiator, crunching through the arguments of his opponents as a martial artist does through a stack of heavily reinforced boards. I could see that the man I had met many years ago had been transformed into one of a very different nature. The one in front of me was gentle, kind, and peaceful. He seemed secure in who he was, and in his role in the theatre of life. Like no other person I had ever met, he seemed to see the pain of his past as a wise old teacher, and yet at the same time he served notice that his life was far more than the sum of events gone by. Julian's eyes glittered in the hope of things yet to come. I was enveloped by his sense of delight for the wonders of this world, and caught up in his unbridled joy for living. It appeared to me that Julian Mantle, hard-hitting, bone-crunching litigation counsel to the well-heeled, had indeed been elevated from a human being passing through life without a care for anyone, to a spiritual being passing through life caring only about others. Perhaps this was the path that I, too, was about to walk. Chapter 12. Action Summary. Julian's Wisdom in a Nutshell. The Symbol. The Fragrant Roses. The Virtue. Selflessly Serve Others. The Wisdom. The quality of your life ultimately comes down to the quality of your contribution. To cultivate the sacredness of each day, live to give. By elevating the lives of others, your life reaches its highest dimensions. The techniques. Practice daily acts of kindness. Give to those who ask. Cultivate richer relationships. Quotable quote. The most noble thing you can do is to give to others. Start focusing on your higher purpose. The monk who sold his Ferrari. Chapter 13. The Timeless Secret of Lifelong Happiness. When I admire the wonder of a sunset or the beauty of the moon, my soul expands in worship of the Creator. Mahatma Gandhi. It had been over 12 hours since Julian had arrived at my house the night before to share the wisdom he had gathered in Savannah. Those 12 hours were, without a doubt, the most important of my life. All at once, I was feeling exhilarated, motivated, and yes, even liberated. Julian had fundamentally changed my outlook on life with Yogi Raman's fable, and the ageless virtues that it represented. I realized that I had not even begun to explore the reaches of my human potential. I had been squandering the daily gifts that life had thrown my way. Julian's wisdom had allowed me the opportunity to come to grips with the wounds that were keeping me from living with the laughter, energy, and fulfillment I knew that I deserved. I felt moved. I'll have to leave soon. You have commitments that are pressing on your time, and I have my own work to tend to, Julian said apologetically. My work can wait. Unfortunately, mine can't, he said with a quick smile. But before I leave, I must reveal the final element of Yogi Raman's magical fable.
You will recall that the sumo wrestler who walked out of the lighthouse in the middle of a beautiful garden, with nothing more than a pink wire cable covering his private parts, slipped on a shiny gold stopwatch and fell to the ground. After what seemed like an eternity, he finally regained consciousness, and the marvelous fragrance of the yellow roses reached his nose. He then jumped to his feet in delight, and was astonished to see a long, winding path studded with millions of tiny diamonds. Of course, our friend the sumo wrestler took the path, and in doing so, lived happily ever after. Seems plausible, I chuckled. Yogi Raman had quite a vivid imagination, I'll agree. But you have seen that his story has a purpose, and that the principles it symbolizes are not only powerful, they are highly practical. True, I agreed, without reservation. The path of diamonds, then, will serve to remind you of the final virtue for enlightened living. By carrying this principle with you through your daily work, you will enrich your life in a way that is difficult for me to describe. You will begin to see the exquisite wonders in the simplest of things, and live with the ecstasy you deserve. And by carrying out your promise to me, and sharing it with others, you will also allow them to transform their world from the ordinary into the extraordinary. Will this take me a while to learn? The principle itself is strikingly straightforward to grasp. But learning how to apply it effectively in all your waking moments will take a couple of weeks of steady practice. Okay, I'm dying to hear it. Funny you say that, because the seventh and final virtue is all about living. The sages of Sivana believed that a truly joyful and rewarding life comes only through a process they called living in the now. These yogis knew that the past is water under the bridge, and the future is a distant sun on the horizon of your imagination. The most important moment is now. Learn to live in it and savor it fully. I understand exactly what you are saying, Julian. I seem to spend most of my day fretting over past events that I have no power to change, or worrying about things to come which never do arrive. My mind is always flooded by a million little thoughts, pulling me in a million different directions. It's really frustrating. Why? It tires me out. I guess I just don't have peace of mind. Yet I have experienced times when my mind is fully occupied on only what was in front of me. Often this happened when I was under the gun to crank out a legal brief, and I didn't have time to think about anything other than the task at hand. I've also felt this kind of total focus when I was playing soccer with the boys and I really wanted to win. Hours seemed to pass by in minutes, and I felt centered. It was as if the only thing that mattered to me was what I was doing in that very moment. Everything else, the worries, the bills, the law practice, didn't count. Come to think of it, these were probably the times when I felt the most peaceful as well. Being engaged in a pursuit that truly challenges you is the surest route to personal satisfaction. But the real key to remember is that happiness is a journey, not a destination. Live for today. There will never be another one quite like it, stated Julian, his smooth hands coming together as if to give a prayer of thanks for being privy to what he had just said. Is that the principle that the path of diamonds in Yogi Raman's fable symbolizes? I asked. Yes, came the succinct reply. Just as the sumo wrestler found lasting fulfillment and joy by walking the path of diamonds, you can have the life you deserve the very moment you start to understand that the path you are currently walking on is one rich with diamonds and other priceless treasures. Stop spending so much time chasing life's big pleasures while you neglect the little ones. Slow things down. Enjoy the beauty and sacredness of all that is around you. You owe this to yourself. Does that mean that I should stop setting big goals for my future and concentrate on the present? No, replied Julian firmly. As I said earlier, goals and dreams for the future
are essential elements in every truly successful life. Hope for what will appear in your future is what gets you out of bed in the morning and what keeps you inspired through your days. Goals energize your life. My point is simply this.